back. Hope you all had a good discussion. So we're going to go through the core groups. Let's try and keep it focused on the two examples initially, and then if there was a wider discussion, we can then come back to that. Pat first.
Okay. You can always tell the degree of cohesiveness of a group by the number of conversations that were going on sidebars to our discussion, but I think actually we accomplished the objective. So in about 5 minutes, let me summarize, and at the end of my comments, obviously invite anybody who is sitting in our room to chime in. So we looked at the question of classification, balance sheet, presentation, P&L for the shares redeemable at fair value first. And I think it was unanimous that everybody believes that the shares redeemable at fair value on demand, meaning outside of the control of the company, should be classified as a liability. The question of whether or not these should be presented as a current or non-current liability was identified by a couple of the members, and some people felt very, very strongly about that, and I think some others were less so. We had some good debate about that. But I think in the end, many people felt, look, if this is something that could be presented to the company at any time, then maybe a current presentation makes sense. But I think that's open to some discussion. Now, on the presentation side, the question is whether or not, two questions really. Should the effects of the changes in the fair value be presented separately, okay, as opposed to being aggregated within other components of income or expense. And I think most people felt, yeah, it's important to have it presented separately. The question, though, that's a little bit more thorny is, as Manuel highlights in his alternative, is should it go through profit and loss? And one individual in our group said, well, this is not really reflective. These changes are not really reflective of the performance of the company. Now, I challenged that view, but we had some good discussion around that. So some people feel that it is reflective of the performance of the company because management is effectively levering the common equity by introducing this type of instrument, and that should be distinguished from ordinary shares that don't have this feature. But, you know, again, you can debate that, and maybe through OCI you present the information that people need, but a little bit less controversial in terms of whether or not it is in fact reflective of performance. Moving over to the cumulative prefs, I think here on the question of balance sheet presentation, I think a lot of people felt that it makes sense to change the classification here from equity to liabilities, although there is this view that, look, if these things are almost like, let's say, 100-year bonds, they're very long dated, potentially, then you could make a case for saying that they're more equity-like than debt-like, or at least very, very deeply subordinated type of debt instruments. And I think the key feature here, you know, that we talked about in the tee-up is whether or not we're going to focus on this feature of whether or not these instruments participate in an upside, because there's a fixed return, both in terms of the return of the par value and the cumulative coupon on the prefs, whether or not that's the key feature to look at. I think I'm going to be biased here. I think that is kind of the bias of the group there in terms of classification. In terms of presentation, this is interesting. I think many of the people felt that it should be reflected in P&L. Should be taken into consideration in your fixed charge coverage ratios. Because this instrument is going to be paid off before your common shareholders, it's going to be taken into consideration in your EPS calculation anyway. So there's a strong case here to say that, again, you're levering the common stock, and because of that, you know, you should reflect that through profit and loss. So I'll invite anybody else from the group to make any comments on that summary. But Olivia?
Yes, on the shares redeemable at fair value on demand, it has always been said that if the price of shares is decreasing because the company does not go well, if the impact is on P&L, the company will make profits. The worse the company becomes, the more profit she makes.
So you supported the OCI? You were part of the group that said OCI? Okay. Mariette?
I just wanted to make one general philosophical comment to the board, which is, I think, in terms of the definition of equity, I think the acid test should be whether there is participation and upside at some point. So anything that is really just where the best case is getting a pre-specified claim, in my book, should be liabilities. Of course, with a bail-in bond, you know, even though you know you might get bailed in at a ridiculously low value, you end up having then the exposure to any potential upside from the equity if things get better in the future. But you know, for these instruments, that clearly isn't the case. And so I think, you know, maybe really it is time to change the operating definition of equity. And then anything that doesn't make that criteria of participating in upside should just automatically go into liabilities. And maybe we can have compounded and hybrid instruments and so forth, but I don't see how something can be equity just because, you know, it gives you liquidity for a very long period of time.
Okay, Sue, do you want to
I didn't do a very good job of controlling my group in terms of getting them to focus on the questions. Didn't succeed. But I think we had, what was interesting for me is I think we had a lot of commonality between the views of CMAC members and GPF members, which I wasn't expecting, so that was interesting. And maybe before I get on to the two specific instruments, which we did talk about, I'll sort of start with my takeaways of the sort of mindset that I think the group was starting with. And I think that the mindset that we're starting with was a general preference for a narrow view of equity, and that was coming from the perspective of those who are really trying to value the ordinary shares. So a lot of comments were made about the complexity today of trying to pick out of equity the things that weren't really the common shares. And so I think as a general proposition, the proposals the board's looking at, which is tipping more things into a liability classification, was seen as a positive thing. Now, having said that, the other point that was made a lot, and you'll like this, Pat, because this is one of your theme tunes, is that where you are in the waterfall matters. So what might look equity-like to an ordinary shareholder and to a senior creditor could be two different things. So having more information about where things fall in a waterfall or a sort of cap table would be a useful piece of information to help a broader range of users of financial statements. So that was sort of my background. Now, moving to the specific examples, the shares redeemable at fair value. I think all of the people in the group agreed that this should be classified as a liability, and the driver for that seemed to be really twofold. One was the potential liquidity claim, the fact that you could be asked to write a check at any moment, and the other thing was coming back to this narrow view of equity and the fact that this in effect ranked ahead of other ordinary shareholders, and that therefore was important. Having said that, Peter Clark asked a provocative question of whether you'd still agree with that if all of the equity in the company was in this form, and I think people said, yeah, that's a harder question. Now, in terms of where we get to then, in terms of where the changes in value should be recognised from a performance statement perspective, I think there were mixed views here. I think everybody agreed that separate presentation was a good thing, so you could see it separately. I think most of the users in the room thought that OCI was a good place to put this. And again, the focus was similar to what Olivia raised, this sort of concern that in times, bad times, recognising a gain in P&L when there might not be the offsetting loss on the asset side perhaps could give counterintuitive results. Having said that, I think we had a little bit of prudence in the room, although we weren't using that label, because people were a little bit more concerned that in good times that would mean that the loss wasn't being booked or the expense wasn't being booked in P&L, and that caused people to hesitate a little bit more. Now, I said views were mixed. I think some from the preparer side were concerned that maybe it wasn't such a black and white case, this P&L versus OCI, even if it was separately presented, particularly if in a particular jurisdiction it did have an effect on what was distributable. Maybe it did in fact make sense to put it in P&L. So there were some mixed views. I also asked a question that from the preparer side, they thought it would be burdensome to have to separate out this effect of the change in fair value and present that separately somewhere. And I think the general view in the room was that that shouldn't be too difficult, given that you would need to take that into account for measurement purposes anyway. So now moving to the perpetual cumulative preference share. Now again, I think starting with this preference for a narrow view of equity, and some actually preferring that we defined equity rather than liabilities. The fact that this perpetual cumulative preference share had a liability label on it was something that the group generally agreed with. And also, again, because of this waterfall thinking. These guys rank ahead of ordinary shareholders, so therefore a liability label was seen as an appropriate thing. Also, from a performance statement perspective, there was a concern that it wouldn't really be appropriate to show any distributions as being like a dividend distribution, that it was more appropriate to have an expense label on it. So the liability classification was seen as a positive from that point of view. Now, having said that, people were, however, thought that it would be helpful to provide some more information beyond just this liability equity cut. And so the point was made that separate presentation within liability to flag that we've got some things in here which are really instruments that the entity cannot default on was an extra piece of information that would be useful for users of financial statements. So I think support for separate presentation of this type of instrument within liability was something that was flagged as well. Did I misrepresent or miss anything out?
Maybe one element for in favour of using OCI as more a conceptual reason is that basically whatever you see in the income statement includes fully the non-controlling interest, but the NCI is NCI itself liability is measured at fair value versus the other elements are not measured at fair value, so there's a measurement mismatch, and OCI is a way to solve measurement mismatch. Has proven to be helpful in solving some measurement mismatches. So that's a maybe also a reason to use OCI for these kind of changes.
Robert, I do think you mischaracterize our the level of ambiguity we had between OCI and P&L. I think that we, as a group, we struggled a lot with it, and I don't think we came to any.
Okay.
I think several of us were conflicted even among ourselves.
Okay. That makes me happier. So thank you for clarifying.
As a preparer, you'd expect me to say, well, these strange items should go to OCI. I'm not sure I agree, because I think there would end up being a possibility to, you know, some of your investment bankers, you bright guys, will do some structuring of transactions. When you think of, you know, in the pharma space and perhaps other tech company spaces, there's when you do acquisitions quite often, there's something called contingent value rights being thrown out. And those are very similar to some of these instruments that you're talking about here. And I could imagine, I haven't obviously had time to think through the example, but if you're not careful, if you end up putting this sort of thing and the revaluation gains in OCI, then I'm sure there is a way of turning a contingent value right into one of these types of instruments, and not having that liability that's set up when you do a business combination. I'm sure we can find a way of structuring it.
Yeah,
so Richard has already done the structuring, by the way. He raised exactly that point, and yes, contingent consideration can be structured to precisely mirror these types of instruments. So do we end up with contingent consideration going into OCI?
And Mariano made the exact same point in our group as well.
So we've got the restructuring corner over there.
One of the questions the board's grappling with is if we did have the separate presentation, and particularly if it was an OCI, what instruments would it relate to? And I think in a sense the ordinary share, otherwise ordinary share that's redeemable at fair value, is the most innocent version. but where do you draw the line? I mean, if you've got a senior liability which is linked to your own share price, does that then go into OCI? And that's one of the things we are aware of and grappling with.
Okay, thank you, Sue. So, Kumar?
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Steve. So as not to disappoint, I think I can fairly report that there was not much congruence in views in our group between users and preparers on the topics. Okay. Regarding the two instruments, we mainly focused on the cumulative preference shares because that was the more common and people were more familiar with that in the group we were in. And let me break it up between the views of the two groups on the cumulative preference shares. The user group clearly felt that this was a liability because the entity has an obligation which should be reflected as such. And it's one of the things also which came very clear when we spoke to them also and asked is that they would be using that for their computations and they would be putting that in their models to as a liability. However, that would not just simply be taken as a current or a non-current liability as we were showing. There would be some overlays and other things put in to determine how that liability would behave or what would be the terms, for example, of that liability, but it would be certainly considered as a liability. Regarding the P&L, because the return was akin to some kind of a finance charge or a cost, people were happy, the users were happy to show this as part of the finance cost. They wouldn't mind additional information, but it was not that critical for them. On the other side, coming to the preparers' view, the key feature for them was that I do not have a current obligation to pay. I can defer my payment. And therefore, this is not a liability for me because I have the right to defer payment. And that also applies for the interest expense that arises from such instruments. Because one of the key things that came out is that why am I accruing for an expense that I know I won't pay? What is the meaning of that? How does it give me a representation of the performance that I'm trying to reflect? So, as I said, there's quite a difference in views. And according to the other side and the preparer side, for all of this, what came out of the discussions, and I think it's been considered by the board, is some kind of more of an attribution statement of the equity or whatever we go through, rather than a P&L expense coming through.
And was that all of your preparers? Because that was the only group that came up with that answer.
I think if I misspoke, I'm sure I'll be corrected.
We're thinking preparers.
Yeah, I think if I misspoke, I'm sure I'll be corrected, but I think on that one, that was pretty unanimous. Mm-hmm. On the other one, however, it was not that unanimous, because by the very same logic, we did raise the question, is that then if you have shares redeemable at fair value, which over which you have no control, then that should be a liability. I think there's a difference in views. Most preparers and users said, yes, they think it's a liability. It should be there. But there is another view where saying this is could be thought of as a transaction between owners. So what is my liability? Regarding the performance reporting of that change in fair value, I think I wouldn't be misquoting if I said most people felt that it is not something to do with performance due to the incomplete measurement aspects and other elements of it that have already been mentioned, and which would be much better to be shown as an attribution, because that's not how they would look at it when they were assessing both users and preparers.
What do you mean by attribution? Is that
out of equity? Take it. Put
so
it
it's not even OCI.
Distribution.
Sorry.
Attribution.
Parts of equity. I don't think we went into that level of specifics, whether it would be OCI movement.
So it's not P&L, not OCI.
No, it could be OCI.
Could be OCI.
Oh, okay.
Or could be an allocation out of retained income into OCI. But
an attribution from retained income to OCI.
So it's still within equity. But
it's an equity transfer.
It's highlighting to ordinary shareholders they don't have full access to everything that's defined as retained income. There is someone that's got another right.
Yeah.
Within retain, within shareholders.
So that's called an expense, isn't it?
No.
We usually use P&L for that.
You know,
no.
Okay, hang on, I'm finished. There's also another thing. There was quite a call for quasi-equity to be brought in, not from the users, from the preparers, which, and the reason being that it does neither classification can capture the features of the hybrid type instruments that are there, which is neither fully equity nor fully liability. So there was a call for that for certain preparers.
Kumar, can I add just one thing? Going back to the cumulative preps, I think the views of all, both the users who wanted the obligation classified as a liability and the preparers who did not, said if it's classified as a liability, then the coupon payment should be shown as a finance cost in P&L. But view was that the change, the other changes in fair value, I think everybody was seeing those as something that should be segregated. So that, that was a distinction that was made between coupon and if other changes are recognized, then those other changes should be segregated either within the P&L or elsewhere. We didn't have a lot on that, but I didn't want people to think all changes in fair value were unanimously supported as P&L.
Okay, I'll tell you what, I'll give you all a vote at the end of this about whether that change in fair value is P&L, OCI, or something else. just think about that. Robert, I know.
Why don't we just invent it?
Well, you said you hadn't decided, so I'm just giving you notice that you're going to have to vote
it. I have to pick.
You have to pick. Okay, done?
Yeah. Anybody else, anything to add if I've misrepresented? No?
Okay.
Sorry.
I just got a comment on that. I mean, I've got a lot of sympathy for the preference shares to stay in equity, but I don't have any sympathy for once the dividend is being waived because that is not being recorded at all. Now, I could see some merits. I mean, and then there's this. I mean, I said in my group, I think one of the worst standards that ever got issued was the earnings per share standard. But it appears in the earnings per share standard there is a shadow calculation that's done for that missing 7% interest, which, if you recognised it as the need to, ISB recognised they needed to do something with that in the earnings per share standard, why have we not got coherence with the recording in financial statements? Whether you record it within equity as a sort of reserved amount of equity or whether you record it in the income statement, I think is a second point. But how on earth you came to a conclusion you had to do something in the share standard, a shadow calculation that's not reflected and not in the financial statements as a measurement requirement is beyond it.
We could have a long discussion about the earnings per share here. we'll try and avoid that. Kevin.
One thing that I was raising that Kumar didn't mention was as a preparer, I was struggling with these examples to reconcile it with my capital management disclosures. And I think you're then forcing me into an alternative performance measure that I'm going to include legitimately, and the SEC can go ballistic, in my capital management to say, well, if I'm classifying, if these cumulative preference shares are an unconditional right to defer, and the industry I'm in with 100-year resources and so forth, I know it's, out there, and I'm treating them as capital, I'm going to restructure my balance sheet under IFRS 7 capital management and reclassify them to capital, because that's the way I'm managing it, because the users can whistle Dixie if they think they're going to get the money back, because I know I'm not going to pay it back in any foreseeable future.
So you'd remove the coupon from your non-GAAP measure?
Yeah. It's part of my capital management. I've got an unconditional right to defer. You whistle Dixie if you think you're getting anything. You're standing with the ordinary shareholders.
Okay, well, the group I was in, I guess, was... very similar to everybody. So we said that both are liabilities. Initially, we said everything should go through the P&L, separate presentation. But then we started to get worried about the counterintuitive effects on the shares redeemable at fair value. And I think we ended up pretty much in OCI as a result. So I think we were fairly close to Pat in terms of our outcome, which is a very short summary of where we were. Anybody like to add to what I just said?
In the liability section, is it really a long-term liability or a perpetual liability? And is there a need for another classification? Because it's not using or you have an ability, as Kevin talked about, to indefinitely defer.
Yeah. And after discussing it going to OCI, we started but didn't finish discussing whether it gets recycled.
I ruled that was out of scope.
Where's talk when
but you can talk about it if you like. Okay, why don't we have my votes then for this fair value change for the shares redeemable at fair value. Everybody's got to vote for either it goes in P&L or it goes in OCI or it goes somewhere else. So who votes for P&L? Yeah, you can vote. Pat, go on, you need to go. P&L. We've got 1, 2, 3.
Did I
just asked. And who votes for OCI? And who votes for somewhere else?
My somewhere else is a line within shareholders' equity. You're being very precise as OCI. I'm saying there could be another line item, still equity. So whether it's OCI or some other line item, it's still equity.
Does it meet the definition of income and expense?
No.
Okay, so that is it's something else. Because OCI is income or expense.
Exactly. It's a performance statement first. Not for us.
Not for us, is it?
Okay. You will classify it somewhere else.
Okay, interesting.
Who was Frank?
Frank, would you like a vote?
He voted.
Look, I completely support P&L unless you tell me it's not a liability, in which case I agree with Kevin.
On the fence. Okay, any other comments on this exercise?
It's an improvement on what? So you are moving in the right direction.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. Steve, just also the disclosures, we didn't touch on that. That's really, yeah. I mean, we still save so much time by getting disclosures right.
That actually relates to my comment, which is just to reiterate thoughts on disclosure about debt and the waterfall. It's hugely important in the ability to sort of assess risk at each level of security and recovery at those levels of security. So cap table with the waterfall that states clearly which securities are where in the cap structure. Just, I know I said it yesterday, so I'll say it again. If I say it one more time before we leave, but.
Pat will pay you later.
Can I ask a question, Steve? And it came up in our group, Pat. Both users in our group said that for the cumulative pref shares, they would, even if they weren't classified as liabilities, they would adjust their coverage ratios, their fixed interest coverage ratios, and their leverage ratios to include those instruments in those ratios. And I was just wondering if that was a common thing that would be done amongst all the users in this group, or would.
I mean, I was in the group, so yeah. I mean, I would absolutely do that for the cumulative, preferred, deferable, perpetual. I would include those in my coverage ratios, because the expectation was that the company has issued this for a specific purpose, and they're going to be paying. The expectation would be that they're going to be paying this coupon. And the only reason why they wouldn't be would be if the company was running into financial difficulties and needed the cash for liquidity. And that would hopefully be, you know, a rare event. So that, you know, and then if they didn't, that would speak volumes about its intention and its ability to issue security like that ever again.
Yeah. Can I add to that? If you look in practice that how many instruments are out there that have some sort of a deferral, and how few instruments actually in practice used that deferral, there is a legal loophole officially created to defer. In practice, every institution will try to pay, and that's reality. That in fact they look like, oh, it's, we can defer it indefinitely. If they do, the market locks up for you as a company, and you will do whatever you can to pay those.
And our financial ratios reflect the economic reality
yeah.
of the business that we're analyzing.
Kevin?
So given where this argument's going, I can follow the logic when we're talking about the listed entities, but if you are a controlled operation and these instruments are now issued by the controlled entity, do we get different answers? Is it right that a wholly owned subsidiary, because IFRS is applicable to every entity, not just the listeds, if they're the wholly owned subsidiary where the shareholder issues these perpetual preferred, that you'd still expect in that wholly owned subsidiary that it's a liability?
But can I redirect to that? Because in that case, it's the one or the other, you know? In both cases, if you forego on the one, it's the same. You can cut it up. It's the same. The same claimant, so it's less relevant in that perspective.
That's what I'm saying. So, like, if we're going to have this rule, it's going to be applicable everywhere. So, if it's less relevant in a controlled entity, then maybe there's situations where in controlled entities, it's more akin to equity than liabilities.
Bertrand?
Yes, just a comment that I will look differently a company with having long. Cumulative preference shares because they have long-term capital commitments, and for some industries it's important to have them. So having a short-term or mid-term bonds and long-term capital commitments makes the analysis different from my point of view.
Okay, Manuel, any final comments?
No, thank you very much. I thought that was
good exercise, and I like the paper. And,
yeah.
Well done. Right, should we have a break for 10 minutes?